it's really about tackling somebody's unconscious bias, right? And to me, it's really important that an organization, large, small, consistently challenges themselves around that.
Hello, and welcome to Disability Done Different, a podcast by DSE where we have candid conversations about all things disability and NDIS. My name is Evie Norfowl.
And I'm Evie's dad.
Do you have a name?
Roland.
And
a big day at DSE today, Evie.
Yes. Yeah. On the day we're recording this, we've just launched our Unpacking the Disability Royal Commission webinar series.
And about a week ago, no, it was 2 weeks ago, you spotted how good this series was going to be.
Well, it didn't take an expert because our colleague Jess Quilty has put together a lineup of some really epic speakers to unpack the Royal Commission's findings, including Royal Commissioner Alastair McEwen, disability rights lawyer, and my personal hero, Natalie Wade. And very excitingly, we've got a speaker from the Department of Social Services who are the task force in charge of going through the recommendations and deciding or making recommendations about what should be implemented. So it's very exciting, and you can find out more about that on our website. But today we have not one, but two special guests. We have Alice Patton and Carol Berry. Alice is a proud Gunai and Wurundjeri woman, mother and grandmother. She has over 25 years' experience in the Aboriginal health sector, and her mission is to ensure that at all levels, First Nations cultural safety is at the table. And Carol Berry is the CEO of the Disability Trust, and Carol has previously held some pretty major roles, including the CEO of the New South Wales Council for Intellectual Disability and senior oversight roles with the Ombudsman and the NDIA. Welcome, Alice, and welcome, Carol.
Thank you. Alice here. Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to a yarn around this conversation today.
And welcome, Carol.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Great. So we've been working with both Alice and Carol for quite a little while now, and I wanted to start off by asking, what brings you two women together?
Well, thanks for the question. I suppose lots of variety of different conversations that's led me to be able to have a contact in Carol Berry as being, you know, the CEO of the Disability Trust. But I think it's also been an appreciation for Carol Berry as an individual. That's an opportunity to have conversations with people at all different levels on the disability journey. So Carol has been, I suppose, being able to push and be strong and determined in having conversations that require different levels, I suppose, or the decision-making in terms of what the vision that I think we both align with. So in a snapshot, it's been many years of a journey, but certainly has been very strongly driven with Carol and myself over the last few years in the cultural lens in that journey. So that's probably it in a quick snapshot. Yep.
And Carol?
Yes. So I met Alice through her son, Yaron, and Yaron is supported by the Disability Trust. And it struck me really quickly after meeting Alice that she is a really powerful advocate and a really powerful person. So I immediately was really she left an impression on me. I also feel very connected to Alice in her journey as a mum, and I really respect her passion for her son and his life and his journey. And so it was just an immediate connection for me, both professionally and personally.
And Alice, I want to talk to you about cultural safety because you talk a lot about cultural safety, but can we talk about it in the context of working with Carol? Carol's CEO of a very large disability organisation. How were you made to feel culturally safe working with someone who's at the top of that organisation?
I think in order to understand that, I think that's what we've been missing as part of this podcast, and certainly a quick acknowledgement to country and all the lands and the waters that you guys are sitting on today and where Carol sits on today and where I do, which is the Dharawal people, and pay my respects to elders past and present. And that's what cultural safety is. It's certainly aligning and understanding how we have, you know, cultural safety at all avenues throughout all areas of somebody's life. And I just want to thank Carol for that, of course, that recognition of Yaron. You know, I have a child that, you know, who's just recently turned 18, who has very high needs disability that requires, you know, very highly skilled team. But in order for that to thrive, it's aligning it with cultural safety. And having cultural safety is the fundamental core part, as much as it is of my son Yaron's disability needs. And having these two different components or my son's identity come together and speak and have the same language and approach to Yaron's holistic care needs is what cultural safety means. And having that at the forefront of Yaron's every well-being, and myself as being his mum, is being able to be at the table and participate and being safe in doing that as an Aboriginal and as a First Nations proud person to participate in the best care needs for him, but myself to be, you know, heard without having to validate or justify or consistently argue or being exhausted by having to demonstrate why I need to have a certain strong pathway for Yaron to thrive and myself to participate. There are quite a lot of things that the Lovely Disability Trust has certainly also taken on board these great conversations and gone, well, how can we do this better? How do we make this the service that adequately services First Nations people without actually having to say that we offer this service just because you're Aboriginal? No, we offer this service because we offer this service through that cultural safety. So I think I've been at the table early, and I know that the Disability Trust has given me a platform to be heard. And we've had some extremely hard conversations. We've had some extremely, you know, sad and very hurtful conversations. And we've had some very challenging conversations. But through an opportunity to be heard and to be validated and to see some of these changes come to effect is what the Disability Trust has allowed me to do. And that's what, you know, keeps me at the table. I want to broaden those. We've got work to do. Oh, 100%, we've got work to do. But we're able to see some of these things come to fruition and able to see those benefits. Yep.
And Carol, what lens would you bring to cultural safety in your work with Alice?
I think that point that Alice made about, you know, we're all human beings first and foremost. You know, it's impossible not to connect emotionally with Yaron and Alice's journey. So I think that was point number one. I think Alice and I just have a connection anyway. For whatever reason, we just happen to, I think, click. But also I feel a very deep sense of commitment to really leaning into this space as a leader. So we have an opportunity to support this beautiful young man, to support Alice and her broader family. That is a privilege. And so I wanted to signal to the rest of the organization how important a privilege this is. I wanted to ensure we work to get it right, but it's also been a pleasure for me to get to know Alice and to get to know Yaron and his journey. So there was a bit of self-interest in it for me too, because it's I really enjoy working with really powerful advocates. I have a background as a lawyer, so one of my first cases was representing a tent embassy here in the Illawarra around the defence of First Nations lands. And so for me, it's also been a journey of learning and listening, which I've been on for, you know, most of my adult life. And so that, you know, for me, the relationship with Alice has been an absolute pleasure and has only added to my learning and understanding.
What I'm hearing you both say quite a bit is that one of the really core components of the cultural safety has been that the learning and listening, as you just said, Carol, and being at the table, as you said, Alice. And what I'm thinking when you're talking about that is that I think a lot of disability service providers would say that one of the core strengths or the core skills they bring to the work of disability service provision is being person-centered and being able to listen and learn and be at the table with someone. But I don't think anybody would say that cultural safety is one of the core skills of the disability service provider sector as a whole. I don't know exactly what my question is, but I'm wondering, Alice, if you can reflect on the disconnect between how we maybe see ourselves and how we're actually able to implement that with First Nations people.
Yeah, that's a great question, even though you didn't ask it. what you're actually referring to is exactly what my journey's been. So we're actually providing a space, but we're not actually asking the question. And the questions that aren't being asked, and I've never been asked with my journey with myself and my son. And the questions that aren't being asked is, are you Aboriginal? Are you, you know, a First Nations person? And firstly, if we're asking the questions, then we want to be clear in, as an organisation provider, why we're asking the questions. What do you have to offer for me as a First Nations person coming to this organisation, but particularly because I have a son that has some challenging high needs? So that's the actual ultimate is. I think that in the best interest of anybody working in the disability sector, certainly you come from, you know, the very understanding of working with vulnerable people. You certainly come with the lens of working with compassion and care, and there are very good guidelines and legislation around that. But what's not actually implemented very well across this journey is, why is it that we must, and I say must, ensure cultural safety pathways with engagement with disability, with Aboriginal disability people? And that's because we all understand the history and the content of this country in order to why not only the disability sector can be a challenging, hard space to work in for cultural safety, but all aspects of my life with engagement in service delivery is always a challenge, because I have to work that lot extra harder to provide that cultural safety. So I think that's the conversation that I bring to Team Yarran, and Team Yarran work really strongly with understanding what cultural safety is, but how we provide that and asking the questions where to from there. So it's stuff around changing the documentation. Why are we asking that question? So that we can put on the table very early in someone's journey. Because if I look back at mine, if I was provided some of this really critical way of working and thinking in the early journey for my son, I could really strongly say that the pathway and the development and a whole lot of this journey would be a completely different outcome. So I think the more crucial we get than understanding with organisations and in the NDIANS around what cultural safety is and why we must have it for First Nations people at every avenue that we work through with disability space. Yeah.
So this is a genuine question, Alice. Are you saying, understand me, understand that I'm Aboriginal? If you're going to ask if I'm Aboriginal, then there are responses that are appropriate. We can talk about listening. We can talk about person-centered is not the right language. We can talk about focusing on you, but also understanding your heritage, your background. Am I oversimplifying what you're saying? I'm really trying to understand.
Great. That's another good part. So I think what this country does very well is they talk about diversity. And there's a real lot of conversations at lots of different tables around, you know, a lot of organisations have diversity and inclusion, but why is it that we actually don't have a representation or a First Nations voice or a First Nations Aboriginal section or component to their you know, governance or to their guidelines or to their, I mean, I understand the Disability Trust in the last 2 years, you know, have developed a RAP and you know, and a lot of organisations have a RAP.
Reconciliation. But,
you know, let's make
plan.
Them meaningful. Let's make them a live, active action document. Let's really unpack it and understand what it really means and why. Not just to say we must, we must, we must. It's really about an educational journey and pathway, but if it's consistently on the table and not just a specific tokenistic recognition of like a NAIDOC week, but if we consistently have the Aboriginal cultural lens through an organisation in every core of its being, then you're providing cultural safety for Aboriginal people who need the service delivered to, but also for Aboriginal people and First Nations people to participate.
So, Carol, is there much pushback from elements of the Disability Trust to doing this work? Is it like...
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say we're an organisation that is very, as a general rule, very open to learning. I think that there is history that people don't understand, and have we been able to assist with educating some of our staff and educating ourselves about that history in order to create more culturally safe spaces? Yes, I think we've been able to do that. So to me, cultural safety, from my perspective, means being respectful, listening, taking every person as an individual, not making assumptions, listening to that person's journey, and just, yeah, I think as non-Aboriginal Australians, we can easily think we have educated ourselves and we kind of get it. But I don't think we'll ever get it. And so I think it's about constantly being open to learning more, and in a very respectful way. To me, that's what cultural safety is.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you say that, but that we can fall into the trap of thinking we know, because I recently read a piece of research that was potentially in the Royal Commission. I'll have to find it and put it in the show notes. But it was saying that actually the evidence around cultural safety training, and I think it was particularly in the context of like online training about First Nations people, can actually result in worse outcomes, because it perpetuates an idea that there is one Aboriginal culture and you can learn it. Yeah. And now that you know it, you can go do cultural safety to people, as if it's something you just had to kind of learn and then do. And I guess like what we've heard really strongly from both of you is that cultural safety is one person at a time. It's about getting to know each individual and deeply listening. But beyond the type of deep listening that I think our sector like to practice as a basis, what is your advice for people wanting to upskill in cultural safety in a way that's actually effective?
I think that's a good conversation starter as well, because it's really about, and Carol, I think we all touched on elements of it, it's really about tackling somebody's unconscious bias, right? And to me, it's really important that an organisation, large, small, consistently challenges themselves around that. And I think that having on some meaningful calendar that ensures that they have not words like it would be great if you could, or it would be recommended if you can. It's really got to be language and words like, as an organisation, you will. And that showing that commitment, you know, to ensuring that staff and service providers, or no matter from the top down, from the bottom up, it doesn't matter where you sit, that the cultural lens is, and the training and the development and the discussion, it's ongoing. Another thing that the difficult conversation with this is the funding and the ensuring and allowing, how do we get this to happen? So for Team Yarran, the cultural funding does not come with my son's plan, NDIS plan, but the Disability Trust support Team Yarran in providing that at a cost.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago when the NDIS started, there was a very significant critique saying that this scheme, which is individualised and market-based, will not work for First Nations people who are a collectivised culture. They're not an individualised culture. We knew that from the start. The scheme has not worked for Aboriginal people. But is that too glib? Is that too simple a response? And it sort of puts it back on you guys as well. You know, you're a collectivised culture, it's an individualised scheme, it's not going to work for you. Can either of you take that and make some sense of it?
Yeah, so it's a real insult, right? Like, you know, with respect, it's really insulting to, you know, I'm a daughter of both parents who were removed, right, from Stolen Gen, and that's live and that tangible, that's my children's grandparents. So when we want to talk about a view around, you know, as a First Nations person in this country, that is, any Aboriginal person you meet will have a great story to tell. My story comes from, you know, consistently having to fight and argue for people to be educated and understand why there's a total different view to what the early stages of this process look like. And I think that's been part of the evidence base of the journey of the NDIS, is that they've started to see in that collective data or gathering evidence, and particularly maybe out of this latest Royal Commission, is the fact that why are there risks or concerns, or the numbers are extremely high, and we're starting to think differently and ask better questions around, well, what is it that we can and can't, and what are we missing? And the most important point is, in my view, it's about actually asking the right people. And, you know, with all due respect, we've just had a major national issue that's just taken the limelight of this country, and rightly so. But at the end of the day, I'm still a local grassroots sovereign person who needs a service and needs a delivery of a service. We've got to have the reasons why we need specific lenses, and not just tokenistic ones that are aligned on the national level for an NDIA and then personalised down through an NDIS. I mean, I, yeah.
Our first question, Alice, to you, which we haven't asked yet, was about the voice, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. And we just haven't got round to it because the conversation's gone in a different direction to begin
Sure.
with. But I do want to ask Carol to comment about that collectivised, whether my question was out of whack. I'm just interested in your opinion, Carol.
I think it's just really important that we avoid generalizations. I think that ultimately, people with disability need tailored supports around their individual needs, and that is a reality. However, the context in which those supports are delivered is highly relevant. So I think we need to keep having conversations with people who were affected by the scheme to say, how's this working for you? Which bits of it are working, which bits of it aren't? In Alice's case, you know, she speaks very eloquently about the need for that cultural funding, which I noticed was picked up in the recommendations from the Disability Royal Commissions, which is fantastic. So how can we keep, we've got this scheme, how can we keep improving it so that it's hitting the target and it's working? So I don't feel it's my place to comment on whether or not it's working for First Nations people, but I would avoid generalizing. That's what I've learned in my experience.
But how do you and I'm not trying to be a smart ass, but how do you bring people forward without generalizing? How do you not say these are some of the sorts of things we're going to be dealing with? One person at a time, fantastic, but the whole approach to implementing cultural safety around Australia without generalisations.
I think so I used to work in market development, and I had some market development responsibilities in the Northern Territory, and we were looking at how we could make the NDIS work better in remote communities in the Northern Territory. And to me, the context of service delivery in remote locations, in remote communities, might be completely different to a context around where you're trying to find supports in a regional city or a built-up city, or a. I just think to say that the scheme is not working for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, in my view, to me, that lacks the nuance of individual stories. And the more that we hear those individual stories, the more color we will get in that the fabric of that story. And that's what I think we need.
Spot on, Carol, but also the perception around what a First Nations person is. So, regardless of my postcode or where I do live, the resources that are could be different resources funded through the NDIA for what they have a terminology or a perception of remote or whatever it may be for my brothers and sisters in different communities across our country is all good and well, but it also doesn't reflect the cultural component that I need as a First Nations person that's having to move to get better adequate services for my son from a remote rural community to a city-based, but the perceptions around that is very different through different lenses as well. But at the end of the day, as a First Nations person, having more conversations around this topic and raising that awareness around adequate funding and why we need it for any Aboriginal person that lives across this country surely is going to be, you know, good outcomes in that process.
Yeah, we're looping back to the topic that I think has been the topic behind everything we've talked about so far today, which is, well, it's felt like it's been here, which is the voice. And we're recording this podcast in early November, so it's been a few weeks since the outcome of the referendum. What have those few weeks been like for you, Alice?
Yeah, thank you. To be honest, it actually wasn't a surprise. You know, I had a feeling all along that would be the outcome. And my personal vote, I don't want to put on the table here what my decision was around what my vote was. But in terms of what the outcome was, really demonstrates what that ignorance was around really fully understanding what the referendum was designed to do. So what it really created was the world that I live in is just bringing it up to the surface was, the discriminative opinions around losing your land and, you know, the list goes on. It was horrific. But I think that it did put some conversation in context across this country that's long overdue. I believe, you know, every black male Aboriginal person has a story to tell. Mine is from the, you know, Jack and George Patton and my grandfathers who were back in 1939, you know, the day of the mourning. And, you know, we've been arguing a long time to be at the conversation at the most senior decision table of this country. And for this voice to fall through is nothing but it has not completely surprised me at all. What I'm frightened of is I have a voice. I've always had one. I need to be heard. And I need the services that are designed particularly for my son, Yaron, to be aligned. And I don't have time to wait for a massive legislation change that could take another 3 to 5 years down the track before they even get anything implemented. I believe that outcomes and changes need to happen now. Yeah. And I would hope that particularly national schemes, state schemes, local schemes, organisations have, you know, a responsibility to step outside the squares and the boxes that they live and work in and to really meaningfully understand what that means to work with First Nations people and challenge yourselves to think about tackling their unconscious bias. But how can we deliver the service? How can we do our business better? We know that we have overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in disabilities. We know that we have massive numbers of Aboriginal people in every box you could tick across this country. How can we do that better? Well, we have a responsibility as a state and federally funded department to start asking people the right questions and start doing change now.
So we're getting towards the end of our time, but I wanted to ask you about language, Alice, because I know you care about it. And that's probably enough of a question, isn't it?
I'm making them do all the work today. Yeah.
It's a good question because it's really important for what's occurred for me, and I can talk about my journey, and I can also comfortably say I know a lot of Aboriginal fellas that have been through the similar journey. And what it is with language is, you know, things that have come across. So Yaron has been, you know, my beautiful darling has been in his own home in a Sill property since he was 15. Now, that's been a really heavy journey. I'm a mother of 5 and a grandmother of 7, and I'm a beautiful mum at that. But I think that demonstrates the level of care that needs for my son. Now, there's another story around that. But in terms of the language, what has occurred and still occurs, but not often, is some of the language words is used as being carers. And what that perception has done for people that work with Yaren, no matter what setting it could be, we could be in doctors or hospitals or dentists or clinics or parks or regardless. But when that word is being used, there's a perception that they are the decision makers, or it's a child protection based placement. And they have been very hard conversations that have ripped my heart, but have also been very hard conversations. So language, another one is that space of out-of-home care. It's certainly an out-of-home care voluntary placement, but why? And I think the language words, when you put those lots of words together, the perceptions that have followed, and it goes back to that cultural safety. Yeah, it goes back to that unconscious bias, and it goes back to those beliefs and opinions of just individuals of what they would perceive when you're using words like that around a young Aboriginal man that doesn't live at home. And the language word have put me numerously in, really unculturally safe positions, and to the detriment of Yaren's care in terms of some decisions would be made without my consent because of the word carer. Language is also important in documentation. One idea is, in filling in paperwork, or documents, or is the sections on some paperwork I've come across where it's got, other considerations, and that's where someone's wrote, yes, Aboriginal. Language and these early point things that we get done right are some of the key things that we can work at to ensure that someone has a much smoother supported pathway in tackling, which we know already is complex, but in tackling the two identities to an Aboriginal person with a disability.
Thank you, Alice. I want to give you the last word, Alice, but I want to give you a chance, Carol, before we wind up. To our audience is intended to be service providers. I think it's a fair bit broader than that. Is there anything you'd like to say, given the conversation we've had? I'd give you a minute to think about it, if you like.
I think that what we have learned through this journey is that you put the person that, in this case, Yaren is at the center of our thinking. He's fundamentally our client, the NDIS participant that we're supporting. But you can't think about Yaren as an individual without everything that sits around him and within him. And so in my mind, Yaren's well-being is intricately linked to Alice's well-being. And so I just think we need to get better at, and it goes to your question about individualizing, the scheme being so individualized, it's a bit of a nonsense. None of us are individuals that operate in the universe, in this sort of strange bubble. And so I think just getting better at recognizing context, getting better at recognizing those relationships, connecting with those relationships, being really real about it, that's where, in my mind, the real magic can happen. And that's what I've enjoyed most about my relationship with Yaren and Alice has been just the fact that fundamentally this is about human connections and the learning that we can get when we open our sort of hearts and minds to somebody else's journey.
So Alice, you may have something you want to say, but I've got a question. Can I ask my question, or do you want to say something?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead. Sure. Yep.
I thought a really lovely way to finish would be for you to tell us about your mob. And I was going to say the shorter version, because I imagine the longer version could run for quite a while.
Exactly right. So I'll try and do it very short. So I live up here, yes, in Darawa land, which is, I live in Sydney, Sutherland area. And I am a Gunai, Wurundjeri, Dadaroa Aboriginal woman. And I proudly come from a strong line of all dedicated, committed Aboriginal family that have consistently fought and argued for their rightful place in this country. And, you know, I don't live on my country at the moment, but I understand the footprints that I walk on here. I miss my home. I connect and go home, which is what I look forward to do with Yarran. Take Yarran back to country. Yarran, I will also say, is Wiradjuri on his father's side, and has a big connection to his mob. And it's very important that, you know, that's the essence of this conversation. We often talk and ask people these questions when we have conversations, and I love it. And it still goes back to that really substance stuff with organisations. Is it's great to have these great yarns, but what are they doing in their organisations to understand what that means for me and Yarran, and understand how we can do that better for blackfellas across this country? And I look forward to going home to catch a fish and see my family. But that's my mob and that's my people.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much, Alice and Carol, for joining us today. And thank you, particularly Alice, for sharing so much of your experience. I'm not going to put you on the spot, but after we finish recording, I am going to ask you both for your recommendations of resources for any listeners who might be listening and thinking, yeah, I really think I could be doing this better. What would be your recommended first step? So I'll get those off you once we finish recording and include them in the show notes.
And if you've been listening and are not thinking you could do this better, you haven't been listening.
So thank you so much, Alice and Carol.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Disability Done Different, a podcast by DSC that's produced by Mayor Thomas and recorded at least on our side in Wurundjeri country.
Another great episode, Evie.
Another great episode. And if you're just sitting there thinking, all these guys do is do great episodes, then guess what? You can tell other people about that by giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, or by telling someone you like about the podcast, like sharing them this episode. Anyway, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.